Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, Andrew Hare on behalf of Ray Forman. I intend to address the first argument in the briefs relating to the trial court's error on the instructions on the affirmative defense of self-defense, and I would rest on the briefs with regard to the second argument. However, if the Court has any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer those. I intend to reserve remaining time for rebuttal. With respect to the trial court's failure to properly and completely instruct on the affirmative defense of self-defense, really the essential analysis here for the Court is a focus on whether the instructions lessened the burden of proof for the prosecution in terms of proving, disproving this particular defense. And affirmative defenses in Colorado are a little bit unique, different from other states, certainly. They're to be treated like elements of the offense. And in that sense, it's important to recognize that in treating affirmative defenses as elements, there's kind of a paradox, if you will, and that is that the prosecution must disprove the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt. It's not like a traditional element in a charge where the prosecution affirmatively proves an element beyond a reasonable doubt. Here they must disprove the element beyond a reasonable doubt. In the elemental instruction, this is tried to be conveyed to the jury by reflecting without the affirmative defense and instruction never what have you. In terms of the actual general instruction on whatever defense is being raised, it will explain to the jury that it is the prosecution's burden to disprove this particular defense. And
for the trial court, did the defendant preserve any instructional objection other than asking for a reference to the affirmative defense in the elemental assault instruction?
It was just with respect to the elemental instruction. Defense counsel and the prosecution recognized he was asking for a reference to the element without the affirmative defense in instruction number, I believe, was 13.
And so that's 14. The only error that's been preserved.
Well, Mr. Forman's position is that the error, that particular error in itself, comprises the error that is a part of, if you will, the general instruction on this, the affirmative defense of self-defense, because in there was the absence of the language requiring the jury to be on guard and make sure that that the prosecution disproves the affirmative defense. So
okay, but defense counsel didn't ask for that instruction below.
He did not ask for that particular instruction.
He didn't tender it.
He did not.
Okay.
My position is that with respect to the constitutional issue of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, that is comprised within the request to have an element submitted within the elemental instruction, that is part and parcel of that. The general instruction simply, again, reinforces to the jury that the prosecution must disprove beyond a reasonable doubt this particular affirmative defense. So we're dealing with a sense of omission with respect to these particular instructions, but also I think the court must also consider what the remaining instructions provide, which are actually misleading, so that when the court is reviewing what instructions are left, what the court is left with reviewing are what the jury actually read, which is that it is an affirmative defense. Without having the instructions that are omitted, the ones that we just talked about, the jury is left with the impression that there is an affirmative defense. Well, no reasonable layperson is going to assume or presume or know that it's the prosecution's burden to disprove. Disproving elements is something that's somewhat unique. The court can see that in the U.S. Supreme Court's discussion in Mulaney versus Wilbur. It's not unheard of, but it's unique. No layperson would know this. And so when they're reading the instructions as they were presented, they would be more likely to presume that it was Mr. Forman's burden to come up with a defense, to prove the defense, to come forward with evidence. And so I think that that's an important consideration as well in analyzing this particular issue and, again, focusing on whether or not the prosecution's burden has been lessened with respect to proving the affirmative defense. With regard to the facts, and really my discussion here is with regard to a harmless beyond a reasonable doubt standard of review, and that's where I've started. And I think in conjunction with that and a review of the facts, we have really the prosecution, both sides acknowledging that the poll star issue for the jury was a resolution of this issue of self-defense, but they don't have the proper burden of proof instructions. They don't have it in the elemental instruction. We have a fluid set of facts, a wide-ranging, messy set of facts, if you will, from both sides. Mr. Foreman said that he'd been attacked not once but twice, and so we have facts that are not susceptible to a finding that certainly not that the evidence is overwhelming that he didn't act in self-defense. It's at issue. It's for the jury to decide, and they should have been able to decide it with proper instructions. I would also add, with regard to this particular area, the state asserts that the court can divine from an interrogatory that the jury would have been able to find self-defense as to the stab wound, but not self-defense as to the hands, because that was involving an act of punching that where Mr. Foreman in his statement said that he was mad at that point. That does not resolve the self-defense issue. It does not foreclose it. In fact, at trial, the court should be aware, Mr. Foreman moved to elect between hands and feet, and the court denied that motion to elect, and the state was ordered to present interrogatories, which they did. These are their interrogatories with regard to hands, feet, and the knife. And they did not object and say, Your Honor, Mr. Foreman should be foreclosed from raising self-defense as to one or more of these particular acts. They recognized, as the court did, that this is one fluid set of facts. You can't divine a jury determination as to one over the other, especially when they didn't know that they were supposed to do that. Lastly, with regard to defense counsel's fleeting comment, he did make mention in his closing that it was the prosecution's burden to disprove the defense. Not having had instructions that actually said that, the jury would actually follow the court's instructions. They're presumed to. In fact, the court's instruction to the jury was that while the lawyers may comment about the law, you're to follow my instructions. And there being no instruction about the burden to disprove, they would not follow that. In fact, they might think he's trying to be underhanded, because as I said, the instructions to characterize it as an affirmative defense, which a reasonable person, a lay person, would understand that to be, it would be the defense burden to come forward with the defense.
Did the prosecutor say what his burden was, closing argument?
I don't believe that the prosecution did. I was looking through my notes and I could not find any comment by the prosecution about that. They did comment repeatedly that self-defense was the main issue in the case. I didn't find any reference to whose burden it was or wasn't, or that the prosecution was taking on the burden. With respect to structural error, I think really the discussion becomes also segues into a discussion about structural error, because structural error in this particular case, I think, is warranted. At least it should be considered seriously by the court, because Sullivan dealt with a deficiency or a defect of reasonable doubt instruction. Here we're talking about no reasonable doubt instruction at all with regard to self-defense. And because of the unique nature of disproving this particular element and the unique nature of what the burden really is versus a general beyond a reasonable doubt instruction as to elements, the jury would not know this. And so really it is a classic kind of instance where there's no object upon which the court could decide really harmless beyond a reasonable doubt in a traditional sense of looking to the facts, looking to the issue that was omitted or what have you.
Well, here we have, we do have a reasonable doubt instruction. There's no contention that the instruction misdefined reasonable doubt.
Correct.
What we have seems more akin to a missing element. As you note, we treat affirmative defenses a little bit differently here, and those are treated as elements, and here that element was omitted from the elemental instruction, and the Supreme Court has held the omission of an element is not subject to structural error analysis.
I totally agree with Your Honor, and I think that the legal link here to structural error is the difference, is that while it's characterized as being treated as an element, the difference is that there is the reverse burden or negative burden that is not traditional and is not really subsumed within the definition of reasonable doubt that the jury got in this case or that they get in a typical case that doesn't involve an affirmative defense. So the point here is that the negative burden, the burden to disprove this particular element, is omitted. And so there's really a misdescription or a misdefinition of the beyond a reasonable doubt standard. It is very akin to Sullivan in that sense, because there has been a misdescription, a misdefining of the burden of proof. And so that's why it becomes a structural error in this unique set of circumstances. I'm not saying that occurs, for example, in Knight where in Knight the language in the general instruction did not contain the language that the prosecution must disprove the defense beyond a reasonable doubt, but it was set forth as an element without the affirmative defense and instruction number, whatever it was. And the court, Judge Russell, said that was adequate to convey to the jury that it was basically a negative burden that the prosecution must disprove this particular defense. And I believe the court, another panel of the court, has also considered a similar issue where there's an absence of the more kind of layman's terms of disproving the defense, but there is the element in the elemental instruction of without the affirmative defense, which the court has said that's enough. This is a unique circumstance where both are missing. And so that in that context, without the jury knowing that there's this negative burden, there's been a misdescription, there is no object upon which the court could apply harmlessness. So Mr. Foreman would ask the court to consider that particular standard of review as well. Nevertheless, under either, he requests a new trial and believes that a new trial is necessary. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Emmy Langley, registration number 39075, and I represent the people in this matter. Today, I would like to go over three reasons why the defendant's assault conviction should not be reversed. And number one is that structural error did not occur. Number two is that the omission of the affirmative defense as an element was constitutionally harmless. And number three, the omission of the corresponding burden of proof was not plain error.
And so it sounds like you're going to concede that there was an error here.
I think that yes, it probably would have been best had the trial court followed the instructions.
The pattern instructions.
Yes. Going to your point, Judge Jones, about structural error, I think the Griego case says that omission of an element and a misdescription of an element is not structural error, and that's what we have here. And that came out based on the U.S. Supreme Court's case that Griego cites, Netter v. U.S., and I think it's pretty clear that, in this case, structural error did not occur. Just no further questions on that. I'll move on to my second point. Defendant only preserved half of his claim. I think we kind of went over this. So therefore, I'm arguing that with respect to whether the element should have been included would be subject to constitutional harmless error analysis, and whether the corresponding burden of proof disproving the affirmative defense beyond a reasonable doubt is subject to plain error analysis. A constitutional error is harmless when the reviewing court is confident beyond a reasonable doubt that the error did not contribute to the verdict obtained. Here, the jury knew they had to consider whether the defendant was acting in self-defense in deciding whether to convict the defendant. Regarding the stabbing, they were presented two versions of the story, whether he acted in self-defense and whether he did not. So they knew that it was, you know, an essential part of the assault charge, and if they had found that he was acting in self-defense, that they could acquit him.
Ms. Langley, you said they were presented with two different versions, a self-defense version and a non-self-defense version. So isn't it important then? I mean, isn't it vital that the jury be instructed as to who has the burden of proof in those circumstances?
Well, I think that it would have been better had the court instructed properly. However, because it was the central issue in the case, the jury was well aware that self-defense was at issue, that they should acquit the defendant if they found self-defense.
Well, there's no doubt it was a central issue, but I guess the problem is the jury goes back to the jury room under these instructions and might very well think, well, the defendant didn't prove he acted in self-defense. These instructions say that the burden of proof instruction number 6 expressly says that it applies to the elements of the offense, and this isn't included in the elements of the offense. So he didn't prove it, so we're not going to find self-defense.
Well, I think if you look at the instructions as a whole, immediately preceding the assault elemental instruction, it refers directly to the assault instruction. It says that it is an affirmative defense to assault self-defense to assault, and they're also given the burden of proof. And defense counsel said during closing argument that the prosecution had the burden. There's nothing in the instructions conflicting with defense counsel's statement.
Did the prosecutor in his closing acknowledge it? He had the burden of disproving.
I don't believe that the prosecutor did said that. I don't remember completely, but I do not believe that that happened. But defense counsel did say that during closing, and the prosecutor did not say, oh, I don't have that burden. The instructions didn't say, oh, I don't have that burden. I think there's nothing conflicting with that. And if you take that with the jury hearing throughout the case that self-defense was at issue, and they were instructed immediately preceding the assault elemental instruction that it is a defense, I think that it's constitutionally harmless in this case. And as far as the jury interrogatory, I think if you look at the evidence as a whole, the evidence of self-defense in this case was not the strongest. He stabbed somebody in the back and then also repeatedly punched her in the face. So I think if you look at the record, he's not in the testimony by the officer. He didn't say that he's not asserting that he acted in self-defense when he punched her repeatedly in the face. And the jury finding that he used his hands and caused an eye wound, it's pretty clear that he did not use the knife. So therefore, if he was mad when he punched her and he didn't say that he was acting in self-defense, I think it's fair to conclude based on the jury's finding that they didn't consider self-defense.
Are you saying that being angry is inconsistent with self-defense?
No, I'm saying under these facts, I don't believe that when he was saying that he was angry when he punched her in the face, that he was acting in self-defense, especially considering that he stabbed her in the back and then he punched her repeatedly in the face. And if there are no further questions, I ask that you can affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence.
Please, the court, with respect to plain error analysis, if the court does resolve the general instruction, the omission of the general instruction, including the language to disprove beyond a reasonable doubt the self-defense, certainly the fact of the omission in the elemental instruction is something the court should consider and weighs in favor of finding plain error with respect to that instruction and vice versa. They are inextricably linked, as I think I discussed in my opening comments. With respect to the Mr. Foreman's statement about being mad, I believe that the question really then becomes whether his act is reasonable under the correct burden of proof and under the elements of the affirmative defense of self-defense. And so those are inextricably linked. And so that the jury can properly resolve this, we would ask that the court reverse for a new trial to the district court. Thank you very much.
We appreciate the arguments of both counsel. The case stands submitted. Counsel are excused. We will issue a written opinion in due course.